Bill McKibben has been observing and writing about climate change for a quarter century. He's one of the nation's leading environmentalists. His 1988 book, The End of Nature, is seen as the first book for a general audience about climate change.
We spoke to him a couple of weeks before Earth Day and asked him to look back and tell us how he saw the state of the planet right now, a quarter century later.
We have, by this point, hundreds of thousands of powerful scientific data points that bring home exactly how badly we've screwed up. In the last day of March, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the world's biggest collection of climate scientists, issued their latest report, and they said climate change is no longer a theoretical problem for the future. It's now breaking over us from every direction. As the ocean grows more acid, as the Arctic melts, as the weather grows more erratic and extreme, as farmers begin to have significant problems growing food, as wildfires extend ever longer into the spring and the fall, as all the phenomenon that we grew to understand and be familiar with during the 10,000 years of the Holocene now enter this new, strange, hyped up, amped up, overcharged world. And of course, we're only at the beginning of it. So far, we've raised the temperature of the planet 1 degree, and that's already causing havoc, 1 degree Celsius. On current trajectories, that'll be 4 or 5 degrees Celsius, 8 or 9 degrees Fahrenheit, before the century is out. And if we do that, then the damage we've already seen will be as nothing. Civilization of the kind we know simply isn't possible on a planet as disrupted as we're trying to make it at this point.
And that same Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that you just mentioned, they're sort of putting it out there that we're officially, it seems, moving from how to stop climate change to how to survive it. Is that how you read the shift right now?
No, it's not. We obviously have to adapt, and as they've said, to the change we've already made. But they've also made it clear that there is no adapting to the level of change that will come unless we stop pouring more carbon into the atmosphere. We have to adapt to that which we can't prevent, but we have to prevent that to which we can't adapt. The world has set a target, a sort of red line of 2-degree temperature increase, 2 degrees Celsius, and said beyond this, we dare not go. If we did everything right from this point on, we might just be able to hold temperature increases to 2 degrees. And if we did, we would have a difficult, even miserable century, but perhaps not an impossible one. But that's going to take summoning everything we can do to get off fossil fuels in very short order and replace power our lives with completely different forms of energy. The good news is, and here's the other thing that's changed in 25 years, we now know that those forms of energy are sufficient, that they work beautifully. If you'd told me 25 years ago, that there would have been days last summer when the country of Germany provided half the power it used from solar panels within its borders, I would have told you that seemed unlikely to me, especially given Germany's latitude, you know. But they've done it because they have serious political will. Think what a country could do that had, Florida, Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, California within its borders.
Are you saying that based on what you've seen about the way some alternative fuel can work and things like solar panels, that we have the tools that we need already, that we're just maybe not implementing them?
That's correct. We have certainly all the tools we need to get started. And one assumes that the more solar panels we put up, the more smart people there are who will figure out how to make those solar panels work better. That's what a learning curve is all about. But we're already dropped the price of solar panels, for instance, by a factor of 90 or 95% over the last 20 years. So the progress is swift. What we now have to do is make political science work as effectively as science and engineering have worked over the last 25 years. The scientists have outlined the problem. They've reached consensus on a difficult problem in chemistry and physics. It's been a model, a triumph of the scientific method. The engineers have done a good job, too. But political science has failed about as badly as science has succeeded. And that's you know, where we need to go to work now. And I think the reason at this point is pretty obvious. 25 years ago, many of us expected that reason would prevail, that if scientists went up, as they have year after year, to Capitol Hill and explained that the worst thing in the world that could happen was happening, our leaders would do something about it. But our leaders have failed to do much about it, and now we understand why. The enormous political power of the fossil fuel industry, the richest industry in the history of the planet, has been sufficient to prevent change from happening. And since we're never going to outspend the fossil fuel industry, those of us who want change are needing to find other currencies to work in. Those are the currencies of movements, passion, spirit, creativity. Sometimes we have to spend our bodies. And so that's, over the last 5 years, been the other most encouraging thing that's happened, the rise of a real movement, not yet big enough to beat the fossil fuel industry all the time, but enough at least to start to challenge them, you know. So far, they haven't been able to build the Keystone Pipeline. So far, we're beginning to see the rise of this divestment movement of colleges and churches and governments around the world getting rid of their fossil fuel stock and putting a political challenge to these heretofore all-powerful companies. So, I would not say I'm an optimist. The name of the book that I wrote about all this 25 years ago was The Cheerful End of Nature. But I would say that I'm really pleased to see that at least a large number of people have decided they're not going to go down without a fight, and who knows how that fight will come out once we get it going.
Bill, one of the things you see when you start reading about the problem of climate change is some people saying, we don't really have the science or the political will or the tools right now to do what we need to do to halt global warming, to halt climate change in its tracks. What we need to do is just cross our fingers and pray for a big technological breakthrough. What do you think of that point of view?
It's like saying, I've got cancer now. Chemotherapy would be expensive and it's onerous, and so I'm going to, instead of having it, I'm going to sit and wait and hope that sometime in the remaining months of my life, someone comes up with a complete new technological breakthrough that allows them to touch my forehead with a wand and make my tumors melt away. That would be nice, but one would be unwise to behave in that fashion.
Now, you mentioned politics, and you're disappointed in what we've seen so far, what's been accomplished. And when he was running, President Obama, he ran on the promise that he'd be an environmental president and he would lead in the face of the challenges posed by climate change. And you've written a lot about the administration's response to global climate change. Give us the report card for the Obama White House.
Well, I'm afraid it's nowhere near as rosy as so many of us hoped it would be. You know, I was just about the first environmentalist to sign on to this Environmentalist for Obama back in 2008. I believed the guy, and he said that this was at the center of his agenda. But within weeks of taking office, his administration summoned a bunch of environmental leaders to the White House, and they told us they weren't going to talk about climate change. They were going to talk about green jobs because it polled better. And they didn't talk about climate change, really, for 4 years. In fact, the president went through the whole 2012 campaign in the hottest year in American history without ever even mentioning climate change, neither he nor Mr. Romney. Look, we've squandered a long period of time. I think the next one of the few places that the president has to begin to show that maybe he's changing his mind is with this decision on the Keystone Pipeline, which we expect sometime this year. We'll see what he does. But, in the course of his presidency, the U.S. has dramatically increased the amount of oil and coal and gas that it produces. We're shipping it all over the world. The net carbon emissions from the United States are on the rise because of that, and it's depressing.
One thing the president has said is that the U.S. needs to be at the vanguard of new energies, clean technology for fuel, and that the country that does that on the global stage will be leading the rest of them. How are we doing on that front?
I think I would invest my money in German technology at this point. They've stolen a real march on us, and the Chinese are pretty far ahead, too. These are the guys who are putting up really big facilities right now and learning the lessons that there are to learn.
Now, there have been accusations launched at the U.S. from other countries that the U.S., and not just under President Obama, but other previous administrations, has dragged its feet, has not really fully engaged in coming to the table and wanting to implement decisive measures to combat climate change. How does the U.S. look when compared to other countries?
Well, look, you can sort of almost measure it objectively. The U.S. theoretically agreed to the Kyoto Protocol, like all the other developed countries of the world in the 1990s, but all the other countries of the world went along and ratified it. We chose not to. We didn't take part. We went to Copenhagen as the 2009 was supposed to be the meeting at which the world came together to solve this problem. 2009 was the period when, you know, the U.S. was truly ascendant as the world's sole superpower. Hillary Clinton was there as Secretary of State. Barack Obama flew in as president. The meeting was an utter bust. Nothing happened. It was the climate equivalent of Munich. It couldn't have been any worse. That was the biggest foreign policy failure of the first Obama administration. He'll get another chance in his second term. The next Copenhagen is in Paris in 2015, and we'll see if they learned any lessons at all.
We're talking with author, environmentalist, and activist Bill McKibben about the state of the environment. For this Earth Day, we're talking with environmental activist and author Bill McKibben about the state of the environment. I sat down to talk with him a couple weeks ago and asked him if he had the ear of President Obama and could help him set the environmental agenda, what would he ask the president to do?
The thing would be to put a serious price on carbon that reflects the damage it does in the environment. And if you did it the right way and rebated the money back to people, you'd make everybody whole. You'd start charging Exxon rent, as it were, for the atmosphere, which they should be paying. That would be a popular program, I think. In fact, the one place where it's really being done well in British Columbia, 60% of the population approves of this tax. I've never seen any polling data indicate 60% of the population approve of any tax. That's not going to happen in the foreseeable future in this country. So we need the president doing everything he can do on his own, like stopping the Keystone Pipeline, and we need him talking about this now all the time. We need him joining those of us in the streets and helping build this kind of movement. But I don't think it's likely to happen because I think he's pretty cautious and centrist about all of this, pretty engaged with the fossil fuel industry. So I expect we're going to have to build the movement outside of the walls of power. You know, though I'm a peaceable sort, I've been arrested twice, chained to the gates of the White House in the last couple of years, and I actually think it's probably more important for us to be outside than in.
Well, let's talk about the Keystone XL pipeline. Your name is one of the first that comes up in association with critics of the Keystone XL pipeline. And as you said, you spent some time in jail, or at least you were arrested. Tell us about that pipeline and what effect you think it could have on the environment.
Well, what it really is a connection up to this huge swath that they call the tar sands in Alberta. It's incredibly dirty oil, the dirtiest oil on Earth, because it's tar, really, and you have to go and heat it from underground by burning natural gas to even make it flow. But quite aside from its particular properties that make it so particularly disgusting, there's just a hell of a lot of it. It's one of the six or seven huge great pools of carbon on Earth, and we've got to keep all of them that we haven't yet exploited in the ground. Yeah, we measure carbon in the atmosphere in parts per million, okay? So at the moment, the atmospheric concentration of CO2 is about 400 parts per million. That's too high. The scientists think that 350 parts per million is as high as we should ever have let it get. That's why I founded a group called 350.org. But 400 is better than 540 parts per million, which is how much the atmosphere, how much carbon the atmosphere would hold if you burned every bit of economically recoverable oil in Alberta. That's why we got to keep that in the ground. It's not the only place. That's why, you know, 350 volunteers are fighting being arrested today and sitting in at the entrance to a proposed vast new coal mine in Australia. It's why we're fighting coal ports on the Pacific Northwest and on and on. But the Keystone Pipeline is an important connection to this huge pool of carbon. And it has, I think the reason it became such an iconic fight is because the president, on his own say-so, without asking John Boehner or Mitch McConnell or anybody else, could block it. And if he did, he'd become the first world leader ever to stop a big project because of its effect on the climate. That might be the thing we need to reopen those international negotiations and get somewhere in Paris next year.
And one of the rallying cries, though, that we've heard in the last, say, 10 years has been that America needs to get off its dependence on foreign oil, and a project like the Keystone XL pipeline could help us achieve that goal. How do you balance those things politically?
Well, first of all, the last time I checked, you're as near the border as I am, but the last time I checked, Canada actually is a foreign country. But the real issue here is we need to get off oil. Our energy dependence problem isn't about where fossil fuel comes from. It's about where carbon goes in the atmosphere. And we have to get off fossil fuel, and everybody else does, because there are no boundaries in the atmosphere. If, you know, we've got record coal exports from the United States right now in the last few years. And wherever you burn it, the carbon raises the temperature of the whole planet. So this is a global problem, and there's no way to find security on your own anymore, if there ever was.
I want to move for a moment to talk about fracking, which is a hot-button issue here in Wisconsin, where the frack sand is mined. What is fracking's effect on the communities around frack sites and on the environment as a whole, as you see it?
Well, you wouldn't want to live near one of these things. In fact, in one of the great moments of irony this year, the CEO of Exxon, Rex Tillerson, joined neighbors in trying to block a fracking well near his house because he didn't want to be living near it. So no one wants to live near these things. They're, of course, gross, as are the sand mining that's damaging so many beautiful environments across the upper Midwest. But the biggest problem with fracking is that it finds us a new source of hydrocarbons at precisely the moment when we don't need it. We need to be getting off coal and gas and oil, not finding whole new ways to go about it. So it's a great tragedy that we've uncovered this and started to do it. And the only people it benefits are the very few people who run gas companies, and they've made out like bandits. And bandits is really the right word when you look at the damage they've done to the landscapes and to the climate that will last for millennia.
A friend of mine watched the Al Gore documentary, An Inconvenient Truth, with their teenage kids, and they were furious afterwards that no one was stepping up and making the hard calls. Are they right to be so angry, or is this just a really hard problem that doesn't have easy solutions?
It's a very hard problem that does have solutions, and the solutions involve standing up to the fossil fuel industry. So your friends were, I guess, right to be angry. On the other hand, they lose that right if they don't step up themselves. There are not leaders who are going to do this for us. There's just too much money in Washington from the fossil fuel industry. That's why we have to build a movement. So if you're angry and if you want to do something about it, yes, change your light bulb. It's important, and I changed all mine. But don't think that you're solving climate change by doing that or anything else on your own. This is a structural and systemic problem. It requires structural and systemic solutions, which means organizing, which means joining together with other people. That's what we do at 350.org, and we're very hopeful that people will join us in this fight. Some of the best climate fighters in the country are in Wisconsin, and it's always a great pleasure to get out to that part of the world and see the things people are doing. So you'll have lots of company if you get in the fight.
I know that you are not just an environmental crusader, you're a father, and nobody cares more about these issues than you do. What do you tell your daughter about the Earth's future?
Well, my daughter turned 21 this month, and so of course, one of those birthdays when one thinks hard about the past and about the future. She's a smart gal, and she knows the fix that we're in, and she's done a great job organizing at her college for divestment, and she knows why we have to do these things. She also knows that it's a beautiful world that we inhabit, and on Earth Day and on every day, one of the things that we need to do is not just fight to protect it, but go out and bear witness to it. Spend a little time in its beauty. Feel the sun on your back, the breeze on your face, and look at the feel, touch the huge variety of other creatures that the good Lord put here next to us, and enjoy it all. When you do, you come back, at least if you're like me, reinvigorated for the fight to keep it going.
As we observe Earth Day today, that was Bill McKibben, author, prominent environmentalist, and activist, talking about the state of the environment.
Hey, here at Central Time, we're always looking for your feedback and your ideas for future segments. We've got a hotline. It's 855-683-5422. Particularly curious to hear your ideas for our Curious Wisconsin segment. We've covered things like, why is there a big M on the highway near Platteville? Secret tunnels under Ripon, lots of interesting, unique things. Is there something you've looked around in the state and thought, what is that? Why is that there? Call in the hotline. Tell us about it. We'll try to find someone who can tell us what it is. 855-683-5422 is the number to call. And you can find that number, or we're going to post that on our Facebook page. And while you're on Facebook or at the hotline, leave your ideas for future topics and guests for us here on Central Time.